Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Bates, good afternoon, welcome.
Hello, Brendan.
Tony, I want to ask you about this interesting event you're doing in the National Concert Hall with the renowned pianist Jonathan Bass. Would link to that, and people will understand as we go on what the connection is. We're going to talk a bit first about anxiety. So you say anxiety is the number one mental health issue of our times.
It is, yes. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's the most prevalent mental health problem that people present with and look for help with.
And so maybe if we talk about what it is first, like, we are wired for anxiety. I presume a certain amount of it is normal and healthy, yeah?
I think anxiety is fundamental to keeping us safe, okay? So when we're crossing the road, anxiety alerts us that something needs our attention. And it mobilizes us to deal with whatever it is we have to face. And in our personal lives, anxiety is also fundamental to our survival. It also alerts us that something is not right, something's unresolved, maybe a feeling, maybe a conflict we need to address in a relationship. Maybe the image I have of myself and keep trying to prop up is too simplistic for the truth. It's not who I am. So in a way, anxiety is the mask that truth wears when we refuse to stop and uncover its face.
Okay, so a symptom rather than the actual problem.
A symptom that is not without some meaning. It means something.
Okay. And how do we know if we've gone past normal levels of anxiety and it's become disordered?
I think it does get out of hand, and it can become a very continual experience for people, keeping them on edge, hypervigilant, exhausted. And I think
it's physical too, isn't it?
It's very physical. Anxiety is very physical. Because it's the whole activation of our nervous system. We're not mental beings, we're physical, you know. So I think it is, I think for me, anxiety is always some denial of our vulnerability. And chronic or constant anxiety is a kind of refusal to accept just how vulnerable we are and that something in particular needs our attention.
And what kind of thing might it be trying to tell us?
Well, I think very often grief in anxiety, unresolved grief, very often unexpressed anger. Something has happened, some injustice, and we're really boiling. Or as I say, sadness, anger, all those feelings can be there. But also the notion that I'm not that kind of person. You know, I'm this kind of person, so I'm holding on to some self-image, but it's not really who I am. I do get hurt. I do get angry. I do get upset. I do worry. Things mean a lot. We care a lot about some things, and we want to make a difference, and we are concerned that we don't have what it takes to face our life and to live it. We're vulnerable, and I think anxiety is trying to push that away. Particularly when it's there for time.
Yeah, it's interesting you say push it away, because I think a lot of people's answer to anxiety as well is to try and push it away or to avoid it or whatever. I presume that's not a good idea, is it?
I think our conversation generally about mental health is always trying to get rid of something. It's trying to push things away. And rather than to engage with it, to learn to live with it sometimes, to understand, to learn how to manage it, but understand what it can teach us also. So, yeah, I think to move towards rather than away from these difficult, the turmoil we feel inside is always the way to go.
Okay, so face the anxiety, welcome it in, make it a cup of tea, and what, kind of interrogate it for ourselves?
I think number one, I think we need to accept that there is a problem, that there's something I'm upset about or I'm anxious about. So very often just recognizing that, you know, I'm not doing okay. Something needs to be put right. That's a start. I think the next place to go is rest, because I think anxiety is extraordinarily wearing. And I think that we need to find some kind of way of calming and resting ourselves. And luckily for all of us, the doorway to rest is always in learning to take the next breath, in learning to breathe fully and to be present, and then to gently give that breath back to the world. And that is where we begin. And also we begin by accepting we're vulnerable, there's a problem, we're going to get to it. But for the moment, we tell the sentry or the sentry at the door of our heart to stand down. Because in anxiety, people are walking the ramparts in their mind, always looking out for something bad to happen. Tell the sentries to stand down. And when we do that, we naturally calm in our own time, and then we can re-inhabit our minds and begin to face what it is this anxiety is trying to tell us.
So you mentioned the conversation we're having about mental health now. Is it good that we talk more about, you know, having anxiety now?
I don't think so. And I know that's probably an unusual thing to say. I like to think of anxiety as an adverb, not a proper noun. It's not something I have. It's a way I am in a particular moment of my time, in a particular, sometimes just for a moment and sometimes for longer. But it's a way I am because I've gotten very used to that. I've gotten used to reacting to anything that seems to be threatening in any way. I get anxious. Maybe that's something I've learned over time. Maybe if that's my default, it sort of carves a furrow in my brain, and therefore it's my go-to experience when I feel threatened or vulnerable. Other people get angry. Other people get depressed. I always seem to default to self-loathing and despair. That was where I went because it was always my fault, whatever was going wrong. So I had to deal with that. But anxiety it is something that becomes
habitual. So it's a habit.
It becomes
than
a habit.
That
yes,
I have
it does. It can.
You see, yeah, the whole conversation about labelling there now, and funny, Marion Keyes earlier saying that she would possibly like to get an ADHD diagnosis because she feels it might explain a lot of things to her and stuff like that. But then you'd worry, okay, so on one hand, does a person then define themselves that way? If you say you have anxiety, they define themselves that way and the story they tell themselves is I have anxiety. Or does it help somebody to separate it from themselves? If you say, look, you have this thing, it's not who you are, you have anxiety.
This is a huge question and it deserves a workshop. Labelling is, on the one hand, a very convenient way to indicate somebody has a particular set of difficulties and needs some support with that.
And as Marion said, I'm not weird. I'm not weird. This is the
that's
thing,
all.
I'm not
because
alone.
Because everybody who feels anxious feels they're the only one and they feel very alone. But the difficulty for me with labelling is that it alienates a person from their own experience, particularly anxiety. That, in other words, there's something for me. There is an understandable, ordinary reason why I'm feeling this way. And I want to kind of come to grips with that and face whatever has to be faced. And also, so when I label it, it becomes sort of this medical problem that I have no control over, that we'll take medication.
Okay.
And then the other thing is that when we say label a child and that, it's very tempting. But the problem is we can then not recognize the child's resilience and their creativity and their own resources in their families that they can draw on to deal with this and to begin to come to terms with this. So it's sort of it lets us off the hook, but on the other hand, it can be alienating us from ourselves.
Okay. And I suppose if you just think, okay, this is a part of who I am, but it's a normal part of who I am, and it's part of lots of things that make
this is how I am, and this is interesting, and I could, maybe when I feel calmer, I can listen to this and be curious about it and ask myself, what is the truth that I'm finding it hard to face?
Okay. It's a defence mechanism too, is it? Because like you feel with a lot of people, worry is almost a safe space for them. You know, the classic, if I don't worry, bad things will happen. And if I worry, I somehow fend off the bad things.
Absolutely. It's a kind of a magical ritual that we have, that if we can... I think worry is just that fear we all have to go there where... To go where we might just feel very hurt. And I think worry is a magical way of not going there. I often think magical, that we know in research that worry is a way of shutting down our feelings. It literally stops us feeling.
Is it?
Yeah, it does. When I worry, it cuts down on my emotional experience. The other thing that worry does, I certainly have found in my own work with people, I found that what they are worried about is not something that might happen in the future, but it's generally something, almost always something that's already happened to them. But they've never been able to come to terms with that when it did happen, for whatever reason. And there's a part of them unconsciously just terrified it'll happen again. So sometimes the answer is to ask, what happened?
Okay.
That was like this, and to deal with that.
Okay. Some people with depression will argue at times, and I'm sure you've been in this space yourself, will you go, well, look, this is a completely rational reaction to me. You know, I am terrible, or things are terrible and things are bleak. Yeah. And the people who aren't depressed, they're the mad ones, right? I'm sure people who are anxious would say, well, the only sane thing in the world we live in is to be anxious.
Well, maybe, okay. But maybe the same thing is to recognise that we are much more vulnerable than we would ever want to admit. And maybe that's the basic human condition that we're trying to pretend we're not. We're trying to pretend we have more control, more capacity, unlimited tolerance for whatever. And actually, we don't.
I think is letting go of control is a big part of all of this, is it?
I think letting go the illusion that we can control far more than we actually have control over. Having control in parts of our life is very important. We'll come to this concert pianist, Jonathan, but yeah. I mean, one of the things he said was he had to learn the difference between he's going out on stage, he's standing in front of everybody, and that's, you know, and he reached a point in his life where he had to actually stand up because he was having such panic and say to the audience, I'm sorry, I can't go on. And he had to walk off the stage. Your kind of worst nightmare, you know.
Okay.
But it was also the moment when he finally began to say to himself, I have a problem and I've been trying to hide this and now I'm going to face it. And he did, and he got through it, and that's why he's talking about it in the concert hall. But he is someone, he said, I had to learn how much was reasonable to expect of myself to control and how much was me trying to cling to a security blanket. That was the way he put it. So he had his rituals, and we all need rituals to help us to cope, whether it's breathing or just settling or talking to someone, checking in with somebody.
And I think a lot of performers in particular
very... But he would have to eat at a certain time, at a certain time of day, and certain food, and he'd have to, you know, go to sleep at a certain time and sleep perfectly and then warm up with specific pieces and, you know, in a certain order, in a certain way. And he said... What ritually might have been helpful became a kind of an obsession. And if it didn't work exactly right, it sort of backfired. It made him feel worse. So he had to learn to one of the things that I found fascinating, he said when he walks out now on stage, he will say, you know, to give a great performance doesn't mean avoiding giving a bad one. Okay, so if before it was, I must not make a mistake. I must not, I must not. Accepting his vulnerability, accepting that mistakes can happen, freed him to be much more creative in his playing and much more able to really channel the truth that he felt was in the piece rather than be obsessed with the notes. He said a beautiful thing, when I listen to pieces I've played, the bits I'm least impressed with are those that I know I've worked at forever and got just perfect.
Yeah.
And he said they lack a passion. He said a great performer has to be willing to make mistakes. A great comedian has to sound corny sometimes. A great anybody has to be willing to go to overshoot the mark, even just to find it,
To accept that you have to take a bit of a risk.
Yeah, sometimes. And then you get into the flow. And so that's what he does now.
And you say you've learned a lot from him.
I have. I really have. I like him, I've spoken a few times with him. He's a musician. He's a person who really feels a deep responsibility to transmit the notes which he sees as the soul of the composer and to bring alive that composer in the room. And he talks a lot about the truth of a piece and honouring the truth. And I found him to be a very truthful, honest person. His difficulty arose when he felt anxious in his adolescence and he said to somebody, I feel very anxious playing that. And the person said, I didn't see anything. It wasn't obvious. So he got the idea that to survive, all he needs to do is to hide his anxiety.
And then
that just spilled over into panic attacks. And he had that awful moment, which in some ways was his lowest moment in his life, but it was also the turning point for his life. And he's written beautifully 4 books and written in the New York Times a lot about it. And he feels many performers struggle and feel very alone in their struggle with anxiety. And he is talking at the concert hall after he plays the Brahms Piano Concerto, which is one of the most horrifically complicated, difficult pieces. But after he does that, he's going to talk about his own experience and really speak to his peers and anybody indeed who's struggled with anxiety, and we all have. And I think he is so clear in his thinking and so open, I think people will find him fascinating.
Okay. Why are this generation so anxious? Are we just recognizing it and labeling it more? Or have we done something to the young people a bit like...
It's a great question, Brendan. I think the reason the increase has been monumental, and the increase in the diagnosing of anxiety has gone from, 12% of children 3 to 17 in 2012 to like 26% in 2021, and correspondingly the increase in prescribing medications has risen phenomenally in that time for anxiety. When people ask what the hell is going on, they find that the reasons are not because of anything medically wrong, but because of changes in our social cultural changes. For example, a kind of decline of the extended family. People are not spending time in community. They're mobile. So they're not rooted, they're not connected. The family has become very nuclear. Children have become domesticated. We want to keep them safe, so we keep them at home. And when they're at home, they're spending more time on TV and devices. And they're very vulnerable to social media, and we know all that.
Yeah.
And schools are increasingly pressurised to achieve academic performance indicators, and that favours some kids, but leaves a lot of kids out that would have been naturally included before. And overall, I think our tolerance for any kind of deviation has reduced. We really have high expectations of each other.
And parents are
everybody.
They're
terrified if their kid isn't living up to this kind of unconscious ideal of what a good child should be that Mary and Joe have down the road. Their kids seem to have it.
So if we could say anything to parents, it would be like you kind of make try and make them more resilient, not so risk-averse.
I think I'd say to parents, just
bad stuff happens and it's okay, like kids.
I think I'd say to parents, you know, here's something to think about. Children are not adults. Children are not small adults. They're people in and of themselves.
Yeah.
They need a much more simplified life. They tolerate and are extraordinarily happy with much simpler things. They don't need the holiday every, you know, the exotic. They are very happy playing with stuff in the garden. At least we always were. It's become harder. But when we expose them, particularly to highly stimulating media stuff, you know, I was watching a kid yesterday in a restaurant and the parents were chatting and kid was about 2.5, 3 and looking at an iPad, and just the rapidity of the images changing, you know, and this kid just watching this and being, I felt, overstimulated. I think we need to be more questioning. We need to ask ourselves, what is the truth we're not facing that anxiety is trying to signal to us? Because it's certainly sounding a loud alarm.
Well, before we get to specific coping skills, let's stick with children. What would you say first to a child who's anxious?
I would always think, and I think for anybody who's anxious, it's you know, what might help, who might help. So I think the priority is always to see, can we steady them up in that moment?
Okay.
And I think I would sometimes, people, when they see a child in great distress, they'll do the 3-3-3 thing, which is the, tell me 3 things you can hear, 3 things you see, tell me 3 parts of your body. These are calming, or, you know,
okay,
let's look, feel your feet on the floor, your bum on the seat. Let's just begin to come back to the present. Anxiety ceases to be as much a problem when we're in the present. And the reason we breathe and do all these things is to come back to the present, bring our focus in the present, because you can't be really in the present and be anxious.
Okay. And in terms of treatment then beyond that, do you think medication can help?
I'm very wary of it. I think for adults, certainly, of course, it can help. But again, I think it needs to be, we need to ask ourselves why and to what extent, how often and for how long are we going to take that? But of course,
So a leg up maybe at times.
A leg up,
but
not a solution. A leg up, but not a solution.
And then how do you treat anxiety with people?
I treat it by just establishing a relationship of trust with them where they can feel safe. I think that's the most important thing. And then helping them to listen to themselves. And that means initially calming, quietening, and then beginning to listen to what it is that's troubling them. And there is always something, and together we will look at that. And eventually, no matter what it is, it's always something that has to be faced. Anxiety is always, it wants to avoid some heartbreak, you know, something difficult.
Wow. Okay.
But actually it's something to face. And when we face it, with most people, it's not a demon with horns. You know, it's a toothless marshmallow pretend monster. It's not as frightening as we build it up in our minds. So, but nobody will believe that unless they have the experience of facing it and saying that wasn't so bad. So for Jonathan, the great concert pianist, to say, I get panic sometimes playing. And to admit that was a huge step. And you know what? Not such a big deal. A lot of people could relate to that. And then, you know, to begin to ease up in the way he practiced and so on. And lots of other things, okay, that he'll tell us about. But
you think the anxiety helped him ultimately in a way?
Oh, I think it taught him a great deal. It's made him much more human, much better channel for the truth of what the composer is wanted to say in their composition, whatever that would be. I think he's just a neat guy. You know, I said to him when I met him, I said, you know, we had something really in common, you know, that I mean, I also knew in my own mind that I would have been an amazing concert pianist. My only problem is I never learned the piano. And he did smile and say, well, that would be a drawback.
I think better to be a potential amazing concert pianist than to maybe try and fail sometimes, yeah. Okay, there's a lot of food for thought there. The feeling I have after it all is let go a little bit.
Yeah.
Let go.
Sometimes the best cure for worry is to let it go.
Let go.
Yeah. That life won't let you down when you begin to face it. You know, it will let you down. It'll break your heart at times, but that you'll come through that. It's okay. But always to ask yourself again, mental health is knowing how I am at any given moment and asking what might help. Or who might help.
That is good mental health.
I think that's what good mental health. It's not about feeling good or feeling bad or not. Yeah, no.
Okay.
It's about, we're going to have all those feelings.
Okay. Dr. Tony Bates, thank you so much. And Tony will be in conversation with Jonathan Biss after his performance with the National Symphony Orchestra at the National Concert Hall on Friday, March 28th. For tickets and more information, go to nch.ie. Tony, as always, thank you very much. You've left me a quivering mess after that.